This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to a Joycast from Joy 94.9. Visit joy.org.au to find out more about our Joycasts.
This is Jim and I'm in the studio with James. Hello, James.
Hello, Jim.
And Stephanie.
Hello.
How are you?
Very good.
And we have a show on human rights. Isn't that unusual? Once again, we have a guest that we interviewed earlier today who we are going to play that interview for you during this show. And we have also in the studio with us Emily Howie, who is the Director of Research and Advocacy at the Human Rights Law Centre here in Melbourne. Hello, Emily.
Hi, everyone.
We made her come ride her bike into Joy Studio. Isn't that fabulous? Because we wanted to be able to eyeball her across the studio because it's much more fun if we do that.
Definitely, and it's a great night for a ride.
Is it nice out there still?
Beautiful, yeah.
Good. So we are going to talk human rights tonight. And Steph, who have we got on the show first?
So our first guest tonight, we spoke to earlier this evening. Her name is Samantha Betts. She was working in Nauru at the detention centre and became a whistleblower and ended up giving evidence at the Senate inquiry into the conditions
she
of that
centre. She was one of those naughty Save the Children Fund staff who the Abbott government accused of all sorts of incitement dissent amongst the asylum seekers, I believe, and they were eventually taken off the island.
We think she's a bit of a hero. So we've got that interview right now, and then we'll be talking about human rights throughout the show. You are on Joy 94.9.
My background is in community development and programs in the community, and at the time I was looking for more international experience and just to work with more cultural diversity, I guess, and get a bit of a grasp of what how other people live. So I had a friend sort of put me onto the job description, and I had a look and I thought it was really interesting work. So I applied, and 3 months later I still hadn't heard anything, so I thought, oh, okay, well, that's the end of that. And then one Tuesday afternoon I got a phone call, and it was Save, and they'd like an interview. So I did the interview on the Wednesday. Thursday I got a call saying that they liked me and to do my police checks. Friday I got my flight itinerary to fly out that Sunday.
Wow.
So that was pretty fast, really.
Yeah, it was really fast, and it was a total whirlwind because I'd put it back in my mind for so long. So I hadn't really kept up to date with the political situation and what was happening on Ireland. So it was really rushed, and I got there completely unprepared. And it was such a whirlwind.
What was it like when you arrived? Was it a bit of a culture shock?
Total culture shock. So I thought Nauru was a little bit more developed than what it actually is.
It's not your typical South Pacific paradise island, is it?
No, absolutely not. So, for example, I was quite surprised to learn that you couldn't really swim on the island because the currents were so strong, and we were advised to not swim unless it was in this specific harbour area where it was actually sort of gated in by a cement wall just for the current. The beaches are relatively, they're not up to sort of our view of luxury. But the island itself, it's really, really hot. It's quite glary. So the whole island is made out of phosphate. So it's this white rock, essentially. So it's very glary. On a good day in summer, it will get around 40 degrees up to 50 degrees.
Wow.
In the tents of where these people are living. It's very humid. There's little to no agriculture, so the health status of the local people is quite questionable. There's so many sort of issues underlying in Nauru itself, that they've just been this forgotten country in the Micronesia region.
And what about inside the detention centre? Can you talk a bit about your work there and I guess the conditions for people living there as well?
Yes. So essentially there's three different compounds on Nauru. So there's three different camps. So I was working in the third one, which was called OPC3, which housed the family groups, the single adult females and the unaccompanied minors, and later on the infants. So I was employed by Save the Children as child and youth recreation worker, and what that is providing a bit of a childhood to the kids. So we would do things after school, so after the Save the Children teachers did their lessons, we would come in and do things like soccer, art and craft, ping pong. We'd bring in a TV and play some Xbox for a while. We'd do dancing and basketball and just try and give these kids a bit of an outlet to engage socially with each other and to actually have some fun.
So that it does sound like quite fun, but unfortunately that wasn't always the case, is that right? Samantha, with this, what I suppose in the length of your time there, or how long were you there, and what were some of the, I suppose, not so positive things that you witnessed?
So I was employed for about 10 months, but our rotations were 3 weeks on island, 3 weeks off. So we got to, it was fly in, fly out. So we had a bit of time at home as well. So the downsides far outweigh any positives that are on that island. For example, they don't have shoes. Well, when I was there, they weren't being supplied with shoes. So even though we'd put on soccer, these poor children had to run around on sharp white rocks that were hot to play soccer. The clothing was completely inadequate. There were kids that we'd have to tie their clothing onto them, like their shorts were so big that they couldn't walk properly. The meal times are all regimented, so they'd eat at sort of set times in the mess hall. The food is completely inadequate and not nutritious, I might add, so people were getting sort of deficiencies in certain vitamins and things like that because it was just so inadequate.
So what kind of food would they be given? What would they have for lunch?
So we're talking about, like, consistent diet of rice, which is fine, except it sits there for so long that it sort of just glugs together.
Oh.
So it becomes this sort of inconsistent goop. And the meat was always the scrappy off-cut filled with sinew and things. So it wasn't necessarily nutritious food compared to what we would set as a standard in Australia.
So would you describe the detention centre as anything other than a prison?
I know this is going to sound a bit controversial, but prisons are actually better than what they're getting there. So I've worked in prisons in Australia, and the clear difference is the psychological detainment that these people are in. So in Australia, if you're sentenced to incarceration, you have had a trial of some description, you have an approximate length of stay, you have access to legal representation and an appeal, and your basic human rights are met. So if you need medical care, you can get it. If you need psychiatric care, you can get it. In these detention centres, they have none of that. And what really wears people down is not having the time or their known length of stay. So they have no idea how long they're going to be in detention for. And that's particularly concerning for kids because they have a hard concept, a hard time conceptualising time anyway.
Sam, how many unaccompanied children are there?
I don't know at present. I really don't know, I'm sorry.
When you were there?
While I was there, we had a group of 20 young males that were all around 17 years old, and the key concern for them while they were in there was as soon as they turned 18, they had to be moved into the adults' camp and separated from their friends and people their age.
So in terms of the protection of children and young people, were the sorts of regulations that we would think acceptable in Australia for child protection available to those kids?
No. So in Nauru, there's no formal justice system. It's quite a tribal system. And that happens as well just inherently because it is such a small community. There's only about 8,000, 10,000 people that live on this island. So everyone sort of knows everyone. So there's no formal justice system in terms of what we know.
Well, they deported the Chief Justice, who was an Australian, and the Chief Magistrate, and the Police Chief, all of whom were Australians, were deported.
Yes, that was quite... quite the scandal at the time as well.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station Joy 94.9.
Hello, darlings. This is Miriam Margulies asking you and ordering you to tune in to Joy 94.9, Australia's only gay and lesbian radio station. It's gorgeous.
Thanks, Miriam. That was really nice. I love your very well-modulated voice. We have just been listening, Steph, to...
So that song was a request from our first guest for this evening, Samantha Betts, and that was My People by The Presets, but covered by Basement Birds. So,
I never realised.
Little known fact, that song is actually about people locked up in detention. Everyone sings and dances as though it's about being in a club, so it's kind of got reappropriated, but
I'm locked up with my people is the major words of it.
We're playing it in solidarity for people who are currently in detention.
Some pretty amazing statements, I suppose, by Sam, and backed up with some amazing facts that it's worse than prison, in her opinion.
I'd be interested to hear your views, Emily. So we've also got Emily Howie in the studio here from the Human Rights Law Centre. What was your response? Were you unsurprised?
Yeah, I mean, we've known for a while that the conditions in Nauru are cruel and inhumane. That's what the UN has said and what numerous reports from NGOs have said. We've had UN...
60 degrees in a tent is not very nice, is it?
Oh, no.
And no shoes.
It's absolutely unacceptable that Australia is sending people to be held in those conditions. And also when we know that loads of other horrible things are going on, we're sending women to a place where they're not safe from sexual violence. There's awful conditions in the camps, and then there's a lack of safety for those who are found to be refugees and living outside the camps. So, I mean, it's an awful set of conditions she's describing, but also just terrible that there's not proper transparency about what's going on inside those places, and that someone like Samantha has to risk prosecution in order for us to know what's going on.
So one of the things she was talking about was the Federal Senate inquiry into the conditions at that detention centre. Do we know what the outcomes of that inquiry have been, if anything?
Is this the Moss inquiry?
The Moss inquiry was actually... an inquiry that the Immigration Department set up, wasn't it,
to look into the allegations that were made against her.
This is run by
her.
The Senate itself.
I guess the simpler question is, you know, you already knew this information. Sam's already given this information to the federal government. What has been the response of the government so far to information like this?
The government, and unfortunately the opposition as well, are both committed to offshore processing. And that means at the moment that we're processing people on Nauru and Manus Island.
Manus Island, which is a hotbed of malaria, by the way, and we send people there who are not exposed to malaria and then wonder why they get ill.
Yeah, and as we say, one of my colleagues was there earlier this year and spoke with some of the men who had been found to be refugees and were living in a transit centre next door to the detention centre. None of them have been resettled outside of the transit centre. So more people on Manus Island have been killed as a result of detention than have actually been resettled. Mm. So both parties are unfortunately committed to offshore processing.
Do you think we should stop calling them detention centres and start calling them concentration camps? Because that's really what they are. I mean, they mightn't have gas chambers, but it's a different sort of concentration camp, isn't it? Because we're concentrating a whole lot of people, 99% of whom are found to be refugees, in an unacceptably inhumane place, without proper facilities and without proper care. The duty of care seems to have gone.
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to talk about these
language
places
important.
As they are. I don't know about calling them concentration camps, but I know that what we need to do is be able to speak to the Australian public and show them what's going on inside these detention centres, because I think most people would be horrified if they were to walk through one of these centres and see the conditions that people are being held in.
So we've got the second half of the interview with Samantha. If you've just tuned in, we're doing it talking tonight about human rights. We've been chatting with Samantha Betts, who was working in Nauru and became a whistleblower. So here is, and with Emily Howie, who we're going to be chatting with more later tonight. But first, here's the second half of our interview with Samantha.
One thing, just going back to your question about child protection, there's no formal child protection system there either. So where we have children who are being abused or neglected in Australia, we have systems in place either to support the family, to support the child, or we have that child removed. There is nothing like that on Nauru.
So did you or any of your colleagues ever report a child to child protection authorities of any sort in Australia? You know, did you report it back to the Department of Human Services in Canberra?
I don't know of the internal workings. We did have a specific child protection team, and they did amazing work in advocating for the safety of those kids. They set up specific training programs for the other stakeholders. So if a child was at risk that somebody else identified, they knew who to go to and save the children. We also had a special team working on projects around the local government bodies of what to do in child protection systems, but I'm not sure of the inner workings of how that was reported back to Australia. Each incident report that we submitted to our managers was reported directly to the Department of Immigration and Border Protection, so they knew of every child abuse case, every incident that child experienced. So there was no sort of, when they say that they didn't know, that's a complete fabrication. They knew every child that was abused on that island.
And Samantha, for our listeners who don't know, you did eventually take, I suppose, the very courageous step of becoming a whistleblower. And that culminated in you, I suppose, making public what you are doing in a similar way tonight, the claims of child abuse, etc., to the Senate committee. Is that correct? And I'm just interested if you can talk us through a little bit of what that felt like, what you did on, you know, what it was, you know, what kinds of revelations were the most shocking, I suppose, uncovered by the Senate in your submission. And also, I suppose, the importance of whistleblower legislation. I know that that's a lot of questions, so I'm sure it would have been a very nerve-wracking period.
Yeah, so the submission process, it starts where you just put in writing what you experienced, what you saw, that sort of thing. So I put that forward, and mine was quite brief compared to some of the other Senate ones because I knew there'd be a lot of overlap. So I did have a bit of a chat to some of the people that I knew were submitting and just said, okay, well, if you're putting that, I'll just make mention to it rather than going into detail. So mine was quite brief. Then I got a call from the Senate Committee Secretary at the time, and she asked me to come in and provide evidence, and I had no idea what that meant. I'm not aware of the political processes because I've never been that way inclined. But I said yes. And I think the main part of that for me is I think I've got a responsibility to the kids of what I saw and what I know is true. And I think it's such a grey area, and there's so much secrecy that's being shrouded around this island that we need to speak out, and it's our responsibility to not be complicit by being silent. And I think that's a really sort of important point to make, that you're sort of living by your values and know that you're either in a majority that's being silent or a vocal minority, and I knew which side I wanted to be on. So the Senate inquiry itself was terrifying. I was so nervous of misrepresenting a fact or forgetting something that I wanted to say, but I was so well supported throughout the process by the committee members, and they all recognised how hard it was for Tash Butcher and I to stand there and speak our truth. The most shocking thing that I found coming out of it was the other stakeholders, their formal response to my submission, which basically alluded to the fact that I was lying, that I didn't know what I was talking about, those sorts of things. But I think that's, it just goes to show how much is invested in how financially invested in this centre because they don't want the truth to come out. And I found it shocking as well that they, the representatives of these stakeholders, were able to sit in person in the Senate inquiry and actively say, "I don't know," when we knew that they knew. I found that really, really hard to reconcile within myself.
I suppose that's why it's so important to have important whistleblower legislation that does protect people like you, because there are vested interests who, as you say, have an interest in not in the public, this not coming into the public domain. Do you have any view on the need for stronger whistleblower legislation in Australia or otherwise?
Yes, absolutely. My first point on that is that the Border Force Act that was recently implemented in June, that needs to be abolished. That is absolute...
Oh, we'd all agree with you on that, don't yep. worry.
So there was an open letter that a few of the doctors, social workers wrote to the Australian public and the Australian government saying this needs to stop. And I'm proud to say that I was one of the signatories on that letter, because you cannot have child protection and child welfare being covered up by legislation and the threat of imprisonment if that person then advocates for that child. It is just so conflicting and so morally wrong that in the 21st century, I don't think we should even be considering that. So I think rather than bolstering the laws for whistleblowers, we need to get rid of the laws that are stopping whistleblowers.
So Samantha, I just want to tell you that before I came in tonight, I was with a group of people, what I call young people, that means people in their late 30s and early 40s. And I told them that I was going to be speaking with you, and they said, "Oh, could you shake her hand from all of us? We think you should shake her hand on behalf of everybody that we know. All our friends and associates think that what she did was fantastic." So I think you'll find that you've actually got a lot more support in the community than those idiot Liberal National Party coalition members in the Senate gave you credit for.
Oh, thank you. That's it's always nice to have, you know, to know that people are out there. And I think it's particularly great for the kids as well to know that there are so many people out there that do care for them and that want change. Am I able to put forward a few things that people can do to actually
absolutely
help?
Go for it.
Okay, so the first one is to handwrite, and yes, I'm saying break out the pen and paper, handwrite a letter to your local and state MPs. Handwritten letters are so much more powerful than those online petitions. I'm not saying that they don't have their validity.
Having worked in a minister's office, you're absolutely right.
Yes. Use the votes next year to reflect your values. So have a look at what party and what representatives are going to best reflect your values and vote for them. And don't be complicit to everyday racism and sort of the casual racism. So tonight, I think it is, the first Syrian refugees are being resettled. And I think it's at a really important time to not be complicit to people vilifying Muslims and refugees in our community. So stand up against those things.
Sam, you're my hero. That's absolutely amazing. Thank you. We do have to wrap up, but thank you so much for talking with us, and I'm sure you will inspire so many more people from listening to this interview. So thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me, guys.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Hi there, Joysters. You are on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. It's now 28 minutes past 10, and we do want you to SMS us on 0427 Joy 949 or email us on air at joy.org.au and enter into this discussion about human rights. We've just been listening to Samantha Betts from Save the Children, or who was from Save the Children, who was one of the whistleblowers about what's going on Nauru. And we have in the studio with us tonight Emily Howie from the Human Rights Law Centre in Melbourne, and who sat here very nicely through that interview. And it was pretty horrible listening to some of those facts that she put forward to us about the conditions on Nauru and the fact that the duty of care that one would expect of that a government would provide to people in its care has seemed to have disappeared.
Mm.
So, Emily, is there any recourse for the general population in this, apart from the voting box?
Oh, for the Australian population?
Yeah.
I mean, we need to put pressure on the government to change these things. And both the opposition and the government think that this is a vote winner, and they need to be told that it isn't, that we can't just use people's lives as a sort of election tool. It's bigger than that.
Is it a vote winner? Because if it is, then I guess the strategy for us as advocates is different.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that it necessarily is, but we've, particularly under the previous Prime Minister, were really dealing in a lot of slogans and removing the kind of evidence base from a lot of policies and laws, and that made it very difficult to actually talk about the nuances of these things.
The previous Prime Minister was roundly congratulated by the neo-Nazis in Germany last week.
Yeah, wasn't that interesting? Yeah.
Who thought that he was a hero and a great statesman. So that says it all, surely.
Mm. But, you know, I think any thing that I reflected on just listening to Sam was really how much at the moment we're just seeing democratic freedoms like free speech and press freedom and protest rights being limited in Australia. And it seems to me like the secrecy around detention is really another chapter of that trend, and one of the more awful ones, because when we do get to have a glimpse of what's going on inside there, it's so awful.
Is there any hope with the new Prime Minister, do you think?
Well, I think it's...
He hasn't done anything yet.
No, I mean, I think it's too early to tell. And you would hope that some of his sort of small L liberal values might come through. That might mean that there's a bit less sloganeering and a bit more thought about policy. But, you know, at the moment, we're still... It's the same government, same policies. And I think we can be hopeful, but I'll wait to see if there's actual change on the ground.
So you mentioned about previous and potentially the current government moving away from evidence-based policy. If we were implementing evidence-based policy around this issue, what would that look like?
Well, I think what needs to happen is that Australia starts to genuinely look for safe pathways for people who are seeking asylum. We're in a kind of unprecedented moment in history with this huge migration of people around the world, huge numbers of displaced people, the most that we've ever had. And what Australia is doing is kind of unilaterally sending people out to sort of foreign countries that we think we can control, to sort of defend our borders in a very myopic kind of vision of how this thing might be done. It can't be done alone. We have to work in cooperation and collaboration with people in our region and beyond there. But we're not seeing that at the moment. Instead, we're just seeing this kind of payments to PNG, payments to Nauru, take our problem, store it
payments
there.
Payments to Cambodia.
And
all four of those
Cambodia,
refugees.
Yeah. And this isn't just damaging for the people who are held in camps there. If you look at the way that Australia's foreign policy is actually progressing as a result of our immigration policies, there is a real turning a blind eye to human rights abuses in the region. And you see it with all the countries that we have so-called border protection relationships. Australia is very fast to sweep human rights issues under the carpet.
We had a guest on talking to us about Sri Lanka a few months ago,
yep,
who detailed the agreement between the Australian government and the Sri Lankan government for the Australian government not to say anything about human rights abuses in Sri Lanka.
Mm.
And they would let us send refugees back to them.
Yeah, I mean, it's really clear. Australia opposed an international war crimes investigation by the United Nations into the war crimes and crimes against humanity committed at the end of the Sri Lankan civil war in 2009, probably the gravest human rights abuses in our region. And Australia sided with countries like Iran and China and Russia in saying we don't think we should have an investigation into these issues. Thankfully, an investigation was set up without Australia's support, and we're now seeing actual transition to justice in Sri Lanka. But, I mean, that was one of the most shameful moments in Australian foreign policy. I was in Geneva when that resolution passed, and the responses from people, from diplomats and other activists, was absolutely horrified by Australia's position on this.
I mean, that takes us to some broader topics, doesn't it? Because it was only last week, I think, that the UN Human Rights Council investigated Australia's human rights record and came up. I mean, I thought it was really interesting watching the news and seeing North Korea and Iran criticising Australia's human rights record. Well, so did it have any real implications for us, that
that
review?
That review is done by all the other countries in the world. So each country, each UN member is reviewed once every 4 years.
So we can have tit for tat against North Korea later, can we?
We can, yeah. We can get our own back at North Korea then. But, I mean, the thing is that North Korea takes a particular position on the United Nations that's different to ours. We have got a long and proud history, actually, of supporting the UN human rights mechanisms. And Australia...
The charter was drafted partly by Australia, wasn't it?
And it was presided over by Doc Evatt.
Yeah.
He was the president of the General Assembly when the UN Charter was passed. Sorry, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was passed.
Mm.
So we've had a long history of being a good citizen in that kind of way. Like, obviously, patchy, Australia is not perfect. But when you look at it comparatively, we are a very human rights-abiding state. And it's really important that states that want to protect and promote victims of human rights are actually there in the council to do that. But, you know, when Australia has got this horrific asylum seeker policy, it casts a really dark shadow over the review that happened in Geneva.
So how serious is Australia's bid to get a seat on the Human Rights Council that Julie Bishop has announced?
Yeah, it's serious. Australia is
Will
running...
Will we get it?
Well, we're running against France and Spain for two seats. And...
Oh. We won't get it against France, will we? Not now.
It's difficult to know. I mean, what we say is that the council bid is a really important opportunity for Australia to get its house in order. The Human Rights Law Centre and Human Rights Watch actually just did a joint report on Australia's readiness to be a member, and we've essentially said... We're not taking a position on whether or not Australia should or shouldn't be, or compared them to France or Spain. But what we've said is there's a couple of things that Australia's really got to do if we want to have credibility as a world leader. And we've got to be consistent and principled about the positions that we take at the UN. And at the moment, that's not what's happening. And we saw it with Sri Lanka. You see it with Cambodia, where the government is weakening kind of criticism of Cambodian human rights abuses.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Hello there, I'm funny lady Judith Lucy. Support Joy 94.9 or else get r***ed.
Hi there, Joysters. You are on Is Nothing Sacred on Joy 94.9. We're talking human rights tonight, as you can hear. We have in the studio with us Emily Landy from... Emily Howie. I've just mixed up our guest surnames.
She?
With a surname later. A surname of a guest we're going to have in a couple of weeks' time. Emily Howie from the Human Rights Law Centre in Melbourne. And we've been talking about the effect of Australia's human rights... migration policies and detention policies on our foreign policy and generally on the politics of the country. But I wanted to ask Emily one question about the death penalty. We've seen a bit of movement around the death penalty issue, haven't we?
Yeah.
We've seen Australians Australians not complaining about the execution of Indonesians who perpetrated acts of terrorism which hit Australians. Mm. And then we've complained bitterly about Australians being executed for drug running in Indonesia. But when we had Elaine Pearson, who is a colleague of yours, I know, from Human Rights Watch on here a few weeks ago, and we talked to her about Australia leading internationally a campaign to abolish the death penalty, at least in our region, and that one of the things we could in fact do to reclaim a bit of credibility in the human rights area was to do that. And we were really pleased to see, in fact, the very next morning a press release went out, which I think you were involved in, about calling for a campaign. Is that serious?
Serious, yeah, it is.
But do we have the ability to do it, given our current reputation?
Yeah, I think we do, because Australia has obviously abolished the death penalty in Australian law, and so can actually speak with some credibility on the world stage. And Australia's supported things like the General Assembly's resolutions that they've had for the last 8 years that are seeking a moratorium on the death penalty. So, you know, we're well placed to do it.
We'd have to be fairly critical of our big trading partners, wouldn't we? The US
and China
and Japan are all death penalty countries.
The way that I think these things can happen is for Australia to work actually in a coalition of other countries that have abolished the death penalty. And even though Asia has actually the highest rate of executions of any region in the world, the Pacific was the only region to be execution-free in 2014. And some Asian countries like the Philippines have actually got a moratorium on the death penalty. So we need to work with other people.
Are there any that have abolished the death penalty in the Asian region except for us in New Zealand?
I don't think so, but I'm not an expert on each country in the region.
Right.
But, you know, Australia has the ability to do this, and the Foreign Minister announced that we would be at the forefront of the global campaign to abolish the death penalty when she announced that we'd be on the Human Rights Council. So, you know, this is something I think we should support the Foreign Minister in, because it would be a really great contribution for Australia to make.
Does it have the support of the Parliament? Because if I remember rightly, I've actually heard some murmurings from some of those crossbench senators that are not very nice about the death penalty and about bringing it back and all that sort of stuff. So
they'd have to. There's a law that was passed about 5 or 6 years ago that prohibits the death penalty and means that none of the states can reintroduce it. So even, you know, the crossbench senators would have to get the support of the majority of parliamentarians to change that law, and I don't think that they've got that at the moment. But, you know, this is a...
It's amazing what whipping up public opinion will do, though, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think, you know, there was a moment when Andrew Chan and Myron Sukumaran were executed that we did feel united as a nation in how senseless and awful that killing was of these men who had already served so much time and who'd shown so much remorse.
We didn't feel that way when Singapore executed an Australian, or two Australians, in fact.
Are you talking about the Van Nguyen
and an earlier one, Bartlett, I think his surname was?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think... The fact that we had that moment of unity is something we should capitalise on. And, I mean, one thing I would say is even though Australia's abolished the death penalty, we still have a way to go in terms of making it really part of our foreign policy. And also we have some work to do at home in terms of preventing the Australian Federal Police from sharing information that leads to the death penalty. And even if the Bali 9 case were to happen again tomorrow, there's no law or guideline that would prevent the AFP from doing exactly the same thing again.
That's a simple law and regulatory change, isn't it, through the Commonwealth Parliament?
Yeah, since the Bali 9 case happened, the AFP have reviewed their guidelines and they've changed them, but they wouldn't prevent the AFP from doing the same thing again. And that's just, we can't be inconsistent, you know, in the same way we can't lecture China or, you know, criticise China and not criticise the United States. We can't prevent extradition to the death penalty under our Extradition Act, but then allow the AFP to share information with its foreign counterparts that leads to the imposition of the death penalty. If we're going to be principled, we need to do it consistently.
Well, thank you, Sarah. That was very clear, and I think that really makes the case quite nicely. It's one of the things that I think we ought to be really supporting. It's one of the few things I think we should be supporting the Turnbull government on, and holding them to account, and hopefully they will be held to account for this. It would be nice to see the appointment of an ambassador for the abolition of the death penalty or something like that, who could, you know, go and represent Australia at these forums. We do have other specialised ambassadors, and so it shouldn't be beyond the wit of somebody in the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade and the Attorney General's Department to come up with something.
Yeah. Well, they're developing a policy at the moment, and a kind of what they call a whole-of-government approach, which I know...
we're familiar with that.
Let me yawn.
Yeah, I know. It's a bit of a yawn, but it is actually a really good time to put those kinds of suggestions
and
to the government.
And has the Human Rights Law Centre been involved through consultation with that? Have they come and asked you?
We've been involved. There's a parliamentary inquiry through the Human Rights Subcommittee of the Joint Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee. And so we're involved in that. I'm actually going to give evidence to the committee tomorrow morning.
And here we are keeping you up late.
Oh, I know. But practising.
Yes. Yes, that is good. You should be well and truly literate
switched
tomorrow.
We've only got time for one more question. So maybe we should ask you what question we should ask to adequately prepare you for tomorrow.
Oh, about the death penalty. Oh, you should ask me about, like, so do I think that the AFP should not give information in drug offences or something? What about if there's a terrorist attack imminent?
If there's a terrorist attack imminent?
Should we have sensible drug law reform to prevent this sort of nonsense?
Yeah, I think, I mean, drug law reform is something that's on the agenda thanks to Fiona Patten in the Victorian Parliament. In terms of the death penalty, it can never be imposed for drug offences. And human rights law actually doesn't prohibit the death penalty in all circumstances, which is interesting, but it has to be, for the most serious offences, it has to be for killing. So in terms of a terrorist attack, I think we need to just remember that Australia is actually providing information overseas, putting people at risk of the death penalty. 95% of the time, it's for drug offences. So that would be in violation of human rights law. Where it's a terrorist attack, you know, maybe we have to think about whether or not there needs to be an exception to allow.
But we can have Australian law that says that that. Things that happen overseas are a crime. In Australia, we do for
yes.
things
yep.
like child protection and the exploitation of children and human trafficking.
Yep.
So we could in fact write a law that really strongly banned information gathering and sharing on the death penalty.
Yes.
In overseas countries.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, we can bind the AFP in the way that they conduct themselves. And
well,
that's
we hope
the
you're
UK
going to recommend
done.
That tomorrow.
We will. We will be doing that.
Excellent.
Well, best
you
of luck.
You heard it first
here, yes. Best of luck tomorrow. And thank you so much for talking with us tonight.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
We'll let you go home to rest before a big day tomorrow. You are on June 94.9. 9. Yes, you're, I'm getting tired as well. You're listening to Is Nothing Sacred.
You can find more Joycast and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Hi there, Joysters. We have now completed our show. We're right at the end of it. It's 3 minutes to 11. That means we've got 3 minutes left.
Thanks so much for our guests tonight. We had Emily Howie from the Australian, Human Rights Law Centre.
That's
and
right.
Samantha Betts, who was a whistleblower who was working in Nauru. And we were very happy to talk to both of those excellent guests.
And if you want to hear this again, we will podcast it so you can go and download our podcast. But it really was a fantastic discussion about human rights. So
joy.org.au. So good night.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.